Now, you can debate the likelihood of any of those projected scenarios, but the point isn't how or when or if we'll reach 5 degrees Celsius warming. The point is that climate change is really hard to imagine. The scale is literally beyond us. And so we're going to need more than science to come to terms with it. We're going to need imagination, as in the arts.
All of this literally took about a minute, though in my memory it's lasted forever.
Novelist Amitav Ghosh.
So I was, I think, 21, and I decided to visit a friend. And while I was visiting this friend, the weather suddenly got worse. The sky was full of clouds. There was strange sort of rain everywhere. And I was walking back to my room in the university when I looked over my shoulder and suddenly I saw this sort of strange sort of finger extruding from a cloud. It was coming whipping down directly at me. You know, other people were sort of huddling against a door under an awning. It was a glass door, I remember. There wouldn't be much shelter for me there. So I ran around the corner and managed to find a little balcony to shelter under. It was a tornado. People had been sucked through the door. Many had been terribly hurt. I think dozens were killed. And it was a disaster scene like I've never ever seen. It was extraordinary. The only tornado in the recorded history of Delhi. And I happened to be there on that road that day, you know, just at that time.
And that is a true story about the storm that nearly killed Amitav Ghosh. Just think of all the great novels the world would have missed, Sea of Poppies and The Glass Palace. Well, Ghosh has been thinking about that storm lately and about all the other weird, freakish weather we're seeing because he's trying to figure out how to write about climate change as a novelist. He makes the case for climate as a crisis of imagination in his new book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. Steve Paulson talked with him.
So when you look back at that experience all those years ago, what do you make of it?
Well, it's a very strange thing. After that, for many years, I did try to write about that experience. And, you know, I'm a novelist. Novelists like to put stuff like this in their books. And I've often tried, but yet I was never able to do it. Simply because the very unlikeliness, the bizarreness of the experience, the very improbability of it was such that it was really impossible to put it in a book. I mean, you know, how do you write a novel which has its own conventions of probability, its own conventions of believability? How do you put it into a novel, you know, that someone is walking down a road and at just that moment, this completely unprecedented thing happens?
I mean, that is so fascinating. I mean, you really are saying that truth is stranger than fiction here.
That is exactly the case. The truth is much, much stranger than fiction. In fact, fiction is a very watered-down version of the world most of the time.
And you say in your book that it's not just novelists who don't really want to deal with these kinds of extreme events. It's our larger intellectual culture. I mean, sure, there's the occasional major storm or earthquake, but those are usually sort of written off as one-off events. And for the most part, we assume that what happens in nature is gradual. It's not sudden and huge.
It's something even stranger than that, I think. You'll see any number of books and films which visualize, as it were, the projected drowning of New York City at some point in the future.
Right. You know? Well, I mean, we're flooded with apocalyptic stories.
We are. And yet, if you ask even your friends, has anyone responded to the actual drowning of New York City in 2012 with a novel, a story, a film, or a painting? There's nothing. Absolutely zero.
So how do you explain that?
I struggle to explain it. I mean, it's just not what the modern creative imagination is about. If you ask any artist or writer what their work is about or what the sphere of art or literature is, the first thing they'll say is that it's a sphere of absolute freedom. And what does freedom mean? In the Western tradition, freedom as the idea of freedom as it's developed is, in some very important respect, freedom from nature. You know, only people who were free of nature were thought to be capable of creating their own history, creating their own art. People who had to live, as it were, responding to nature constantly were people who were thought to be without consciousness, without history, without art.
And that's sort of the traditional definition of culture. Culture is what is not nature.
Traditional since the late 18th century. I mean, that's when these divisions were put in place. Before that, really, these distinctions never applied.
So you're talking about the Enlightenment here. I mean, these are Enlightenment values that put human beings at the center of everything.
That's really it. Yes, it's absolutely the case that it was within the Enlightenment that, you know, you have this deification of humanity, the centrality of the human, and the exclusion of the non-human from everything, really.
So I want to come back to your profession, writing novels, and this whole question of why novelists don't write about these cataclysmic storms. First of all, I wonder if that's actually true. I mean, there's this recent surge in what's been called cli-fi, climate fiction. Where do you put those novels?
It's certainly true that there is a lot being written, you know, about events like these, what might happen. But again, let me just come back to the example that I started with. There's any number of novels and films and so on about the possible drowning of New York, and yet there's nothing about the actual drowning of New York, you know?
You're talking about those novels that are set in the future, and I suppose that
exactly.
we might sort of classify as science fiction.
But yeah, as various sort of genres of science fiction. And that's actually something that really troubles me, because I think when our only way of dealing with these issues is by projecting them into a landscape of fantasy, really what we're doing is the same thing as a sort of denial, you know, of the reality of our lives. Because, you know, climate change is not in the future. Climate change is now. It's happening. It's all around us. When we project these things so much into the future, we actually give people a way of not dealing with these issues.
So you're saying that I guess what we would call serious fiction, literary fiction, that's pretty much stayed away from climate change. I mean, it's been left to fantasy. It's been left to science fiction. Oh, you know, these catastrophes that might happen in the future. But those people who are writing novels about our lives today, they pretty much stay away from that issue.
Yes, it's not entirely the case. I mean, Ian McEwan has written, you know, about climate change in his book Solar. Barbara Kingsolver has written a wonderful novel about in which climate change plays a part. It's called Flight Behavior. But it is largely absent. I mean, if you look at the mainstream of literary fiction today, it's carrying on much as it was 20 or 30 years ago. And there seems to be absolutely no recognition of the profound rupture that divides the world of today from the world of, 1990.
So I have to ask about you. Has climate change figured in your own fiction?
It has, but in oblique ways. And let me just say here that, this book that I've written, The Great Derangement, in a way, it's an introspection. It's really me trying to cope with my own inability to grapple with climate change, you know? So I'm not pointing the finger at anyone, nor is it in any way my intention to reprove other writers for what they choose to write about. I mean, that's none of my business, really. So I'm trying to explore my own limitations, if you like. I mean, I really believe, you know, that like people of my generation, we used to ask our parents, what did you do in the war, you know,
right,
in the Second World War? Our children are going to say to us, how did you respond to this? And really, I think the world of the arts and culture will not have a very convincing response.
Now, you said that your goal is not to point fingers, but you do point a finger at least one person, John Updike, who in a book review years ago once defined the purpose of the novel as an individual moral adventure, which is a fascinating idea. I mean, there's a whole philosophy there of what he thinks a novel is supposed to be. You take issue with that idea, right?
Yes, but what is so interesting to me is that Updike's statement of this really comes about at exactly the same time that we have this sort of invention of a neoliberal economics where everything is really about individual choices. This has had a profound effect on all our thinking in so many ways, and it certainly has profoundly affected the ways that artists and novelists think about their work.
How so?
Well, you look at earlier kinds of novels. I mean, take an iconic, a really great American novel like Grapes of Wrath. How could you possibly call that an individual moral adventure?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this novel, Grapes of Wrath, is perhaps the single most influential novel written by an American in the 20th century. It's in every way a novel about a collective predicament. If we take a novel like Grapes of Wrath, or you take another great iconic novel, American novel, Moby Dick, which to me is perhaps the greatest novel of the 19th century, if not of all time. In what way would you describe this as an individual moral adventure? It's not. It's something else. It's about a collective predicament.
Okay, so if the novel, if we're living in a different age now, and we need a new mindset, a different sort of imaginative space, what would it mean to write about a universe that is animated by non-human voices?
That's really the problem, isn't it? I mean, because the non-human has no place within novels as such, you know, because novels are, they grow out of this whole process of separating the human and the non-human. Again, let me return, though, to Moby Dick. One of the reasons why Moby Dick is really such an extraordinary novel is because it doesn't make this separation between the human and the non-human. To Melville, the whale is very much a creature with intention. Melville never makes a distinction in that sense between the world of the human and the non-human. I mean, in his book, he returns time and time again to telling us what whales do or what whales are, you know. I mean, you know, that's something so hard to imagine in the world of today's literature. And yet, it's exactly that that makes Moby Dick such a transcendent piece of writing.
Amitav Ghosh is an award-winning novelist, author of Sea of Poppies and Flood of Fire, and he and Steve were talking about his new nonfiction book, The Great Derangement: Climate Change and the Unthinkable.